I've been getting some emails and requests asking me to speak a little bit more about this concept of reading from below or reading from above. Reading from below means to read the texts of the Bible, especially of the New Testament, with a realization that the people who wrote those words and the first audience who was reading them did not have power in the world. They were writing by and for and about people on the margins, and people who were not seeking to build their power and lord it over others, as Jesus said. And they were people who found themselves, as I say, on the margins or persecuted or ignored. They had left behind their allegiances of their families and their tribes and their nations, and they were forming a new family, a royal priesthood, a new nation. And this was what it meant to read from below. It means to not read as if you are in charge. And if you want to see a good example of what happens when you read from above, then the best thing to do is to look at how Christians today treat Romans 13, 1-7. Almost uniformly, Christians today who find themselves in cultural positions of power, who have their fingers on the levers and the buttons of the mechanism of government, or who find themselves closely aligning their good patriotism and good citizenship with their Christian culture, will invariably find in these texts their knockdown proof text arguments for military engagement, for allegiance to governments, no matter what, for weaponized police force, for capital punishment, etc., etc. I mean, it's not... The hypocrisy is blatant here, because the same sorts of groups that like to shout Romans 13, 1-7, and when they are supporting Trump, will be the ones who are strangely silent when there's a president in power that they don't like. The same groups that are shouting Romans 13, 1-7 at Black Lives Matter protesters often are themselves the ones who were out not obeying any coronavirus lockdown restrictions because their freedoms were being challenged. So it's pretty obvious and pretty blatant how selective conservative evangelicals and charismatics will be in their use of these texts. They pretty much only ever apply it. It only ever comes out of the woodwork when the government is saying something that they already like. And then when the government or the powers that be do things they don't like, then all of a sudden Romans 13, 1-7 is nowhere to be found. I think, to be fair, this is one of those odd little passages of the Bible that looks on the surface of it to be really obvious what it's talking about. And if you're not somebody who's already reading from below, if you're not somebody who's been trained or whose imagination is being channeled towards thinking along kingdom politics or Jesus way politics, if your imagination is already colonized by patriotism and law and order citizenship and the idea that Christianity is a moral force primarily in the world, if you believe all that already, then it's fair enough that if you read Romans 13, 1-7, your mind will quite easily slot into place and see in these verses what looks like a pretty clear proof text for patriotism. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. For the same reason, you also pay taxes, for the authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. Pay to all what is owed to them, taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, honor to whom honor is owed. Right? Seems really obvious. It seems like a pretty clear cut. We need to show our patriotism. We need to involve ourselves in acts of state-sponsored violence when the state requires it. We need to wield the sword, because this is how God's wrath is shown on evildoers. So therefore, when your young person comes to you and says, I think God's calling me to join the military, or I think I'm supposed to be a judge who's going to mete out the capital punishment on criminals, or I think I'm going to join a police force which has a culture of shoot to kill in times of necessity, well then, God bless you. Go for it. Oh, and while you're at it, make sure you only read Romans 13, 1-7 over and over again. Don't read any of the Gospels. Don't read Philippians. Don't pay any attention to Galatians or 1st or 2nd Corinthians. Don't read the rest of Romans either. Just read Romans 13, 1-7, and you'll be fine. Those of us who are trying to do the work of becoming followers of the way of Jesus and renewing our political imagination in the light of that way are at a distinct disadvantage at this point, because all the easy soundbite common sense philosophies belong to the other side. It's not that hard to just proof text these passages. The problem is that the real truth of them is a little bit harder to say, and it's especially hard to say to audiences of people who are already trained to hear what they want to hear. Basically, who are already trained to expect that their Christianity will make them better patriots. Because that's what patriotism does. It creates people who are willing to die and kill for the country. That's the whole point. And we have a whole culture which is geared towards that, and it's a very successful ideology. It's no accident that another name for patriotism is jingoism. Patriotism has all the short, pithy phrases. It's got all the sound bites. It's got all the phrases that stick straight to the heart, get the emotions going, and make you feel good about yourself. And so to be on the other side of patriotism is already to set yourself up for a pretty uphill slog. A famous preacher who I have mentioned in previous episodes, he once asked me for feedback. He'd been giving a series of sermons on Romans 13, and he, to his credit, he'd heard I was in his environment, and so he asked for feedback. You know, true to form, his sermons were all pretty much what I've just described here. They were justifications for Americans dropping bombs on Iraqis and joining the military and a militarized police force and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it was pretty typical law and order type sermon. And, I gave him my feedback and I told him the kinds of things that I'm about to talk about in this session, which aren't straightforward and they do take a bit of work to understand. And he leans over and he slaps me good-naturedly on the shoulder and says, yeah, you try telling that to the soldiers and the policemen in my audience. And I thought, this is the problem. The problem is that because it's hard to teach or hard to preach, we don't seek the truth. We only keep going down the furrows and the channels that have been set for us by a different agenda. The agenda of law and order patriotism is governing how we read Romans, which is doubly frustrating because in Romans, Paul is working out a pretty thoroughgoing view of politics based on the way of Jesus. So let's read from below. Not as somebody whose finger is on the trigger, or whose hand is over his heart, or who's looking up at a fluttering flag and thinking, yeah, it's my Christian duty to love and serve that flag. What happens instead if we join somebody who's in chains at the behest of the government, who is about to be killed by the government, and who has always had to face opposition from rulers and authorities everywhere he went? What happens when we read from below? Well, I think the first thing you have to say when reading Romans 13, 1-7, is stop starting at Romans 13, 1-7. Chapters and verses were added later, after the fact, Paul didn't write in chapter and verse. He wrote one long letter. And chapters and verses have been inserted for various reasons, usually to do with translation or reading along so that people could literally stay on the same page with each other. But these chapter headings have actually changed the course of history. They have also played their part in colonizing and capturing our imaginations. So, for example, what happens if we started our reading at Romans 12, verse 14? Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be conceited. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink, for by so doing you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Gee, I wonder what Paul's example of overcoming evil with good is. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. One of the first things we have to notice about Romans 13:1-7 is that government and the ruling authorities are very much in the realm and sphere of evil in Paul's imagination. They're part of the powers and principality language that we discussed earlier in the last session, in Ephesians 6, where he talks about ruling authorities and spiritual warfare. And now he uses the same language for government in Romans 13. So first of all, if you're thinking that he thinks government is wonderful and brilliant and should be respected because it's so much higher than us, you're missing the point. Government is a fallen principality. It's in fact gone corrupt. The wrath of God language is language that's being used to describe elsewhere in the New Testament, what happens when people get the evil that they want? God gives them over. In Romans, he said, God gives people over to their own desires. And it's experienced as a wrath. It's like getting what you want is its own punishment. And here we have people who are doing like what Jesus said, if you live by the sword, you will die by the sword. The wrathful, vengeance-seeking cycles of violence and killing in order to solve violence and killing is part of a sphere of activity which Paul distinctly tells his people not to have anything to do with. Romans 12, do not seek revenge, but leave it to the wrath of God. And then later on, within 5 seconds, he says it's the government that bears the sword that has to do with wrath dealing. And in Paul's imagination, there is an activity that belongs to the sphere of the principality of government, which is not something that believers are meant to partake in. Paul has a distinction. And the one thing that he told his believers not to do in Romans 12, he then says that's what the state or the government does in Romans 13. And it has to do with this idea that the wrath of God is almost like a force of nature. It's almost like the natural course of things. And that if you play by those particular rules, that's what's going to happen to you. And Paul here is doing like we talked about in the last session. He's identified a principality, and now he's telling that principality what its purpose is. He's putting it in its place. He's saying, that the government is there to deal with wrath, vengeance, and law-breaking. And here is a little bit of something to do with reading from below, because you have to remember that, of course, the earliest followers of Jesus, when they were noticed by Rome at all, which, by the way, they often were ignored by Rome, but when they were noticed by Rome, it was to mock them, to belittle them, or to persecute them. Paul has no pretensions to power. His readers have no pretensions to power. This is not a text or a manual for how to act when you find yourself in government. What this is a manual or a text for people who find themselves under the thumb of government. They are the little ants who are scurrying around while government is looming over them with a magnifying glass. And one of the charges against these Christians was that they were seditious and that they violently were going to oppose the governor. Remember, to say that Jesus is Lord is to say that Caesar is not. Caesar is Lord was the phrase you had to pronounce in order to prove yourself to be a good citizen of the empire. And the earliest rallying cry of the Christians, after they came up out of their baptismal font, was Jesus is Lord. And it was a political phrase. And so the whole identity of the followers of Jesus was already, in the earliest church, a political identity set at odds with others. And the Christians were known for their meetings with Jews and Gentiles together. They were known for upsetting social boundaries. Slaves and masters would be together in one room. Men and women would have joint leadership positions or joint public positions in the church. Basically, they were an unruly lot that when Rome looked at them, they only saw potential trouble. And Rome pretty much had only one imagination when it came to rebels. They only saw that you could be an armed rebel. That was the only way to rebel against Roman Empire. And the earliest Christians knew that there was a different way. They had an alternative politics. And Peter in his letters and Paul here in Romans, they spend some time trying to convince or trying to encourage the Christians how to act in public in the face of a Roman Empire that assumes that anyone who doesn't ascribe to the emperor and his superiority must be a violent rebel. And so it's really important for the early Christians, the leaders, to write and to say to the Christians, don't give the government cause to think that you are one of these violent rebels that they expect you to be. Don't be like that. As far as it is possible, as long as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Don't pick up the sword. Keep your head down. We've got other things to worry about. Another aspect of Romans, which is related, is that here is Paul, who is writing as somebody who's not important to a group of people who aren't important, and yet he's deigning to tell the government what it's there for. And he's not actually talking to the government, of course. He's talking to fellow Christians, to fellow believers. And he's resetting or reimagining the world around them. In Romans 8, just 5 minutes in reading time previous to this, he has identified that the believers are sons of God, fellow heirs with the ruler of the universe. And now in Romans 13, he says, for example, in verse 4, Caesar is God's servant. Paul wants the sons of God to submit to the servant. This is not a passage where the government is so great that we must bow down and scrape and do whatever it is that it asks of us. This is an example of the older, stronger brother submitting to the weaker brother. Now, look, I am not going to defend the way that the word submission has been used and abused by Christians and their systems throughout history. Obviously, this has not been a good thing for lots of people. I will, however, point out that the abuse of the word submission has come entirely from Christians who find themselves, in places of power, find themselves responsible for institutions and countries and nations, and think that being a Christian is about law and order. But if you go back in and look at the way the submission is used in the actual primary texts, the very first people who use this word, you realize that mutual submission is not about domination and law and order. It's about laying down your will for the sake of another person's will. And I am going to talk about this in a future episode, which is why I'm not going into it here. But just know that submission in the New Testament is not something that lowly, cringing, inferior people do to superior people. Jesus submitted to death, even death on a cross. He willingly laid down his life. And it's seen as the ultimate godlike thing to do. So when the New Testament talks about everyone submit one to another, it's not saying become cringing worms. It's almost the opposite. You can't control yourself unless there's a self to control. You can't put a limit on your own will and what you want unless you already have a will and you know what you want. So the submission type teaching in the New Testament is one of telling people, control your power. You have power and this is how you use it. And again, I'm going to talk about this in a future episode, but essentially it's don't use your power to dominate others. When you practice submission, you are refusing to use your will to dominate over other people's wills. You're making space for them. Submission can be a very empowering thing because what you're doing is you are recognizing the validity of the person that you are submitting to. You're admitting that they have a will and a purpose and a place in this world, and you're refusing to let your own ego or your own power railroad over them and push them out. And we see this even here in Romans 13, where the act of submission to the government, to the servant, by the sons of God, is a way of recognizing the government's basic humanity and validity of existence. And it needs to be quickly said here that there are many words in Greek for obedience, but Paul doesn't use any of them. He says submission, and submission is not the same as obedience. You can submit to the government without obeying it. A good example is where in the book of Acts, where Peter and John are preaching in the marketplace and they're taken up by the authorities and they're told to stop preaching in the name of Jesus. So what do Peter and John do? They go back out and they promptly disobey the government and they keep preaching in the name of Jesus. And then what happens? The soldiers come and Peter and John are arrested. Nowhere do Peter and John deny the validity of the government. They don't deny that the people who are placed in rule over them have a responsibility for keeping the peace. If they denied the validity of the government, they would have acted very differently. But what they do is they submit to the punishment, they are put in prison, there's an earthquake, the doors fly open, and they stay in prison. Disobedience with submission. Even here in Romans 13, there's an interesting little wrinkle between the idea of submission and the idea of total obedience. Have a look at verse 7, where the believers are enjoined to render to Caesar what is owed to him, or to give to the government what is owed to him, which is a clear reference here to Jesus's teaching, to render unto Caesar. Paul doesn't quote Jesus directly very much. He quotes him at the end of Romans 12, and then he quotes him here in Romans 13:7. This is very significant. This is part of the way of Jesus informing the politics of Paul. And he tells them, you got to pay to what the government is owed to them. Hang on. You don't give to the government or to Caesar everything he asks for. You give him what is owed. And who decides what he's owed? We do. The sons of God do. There's an implicit instruction here to render with discrimination. It's the same kind of attitude that Jesus had when they asked him about, should we pay this temple tax? And he says, render to Caesar what's got his image on it and give to God what's got his image. Rendering what to Caesar he is owed is not the same as giving to Caesar everything he asks for. And in fact, what follows in Paul's list is a pretty limited set of things. Give taxes, give revenue, and respect and honor. And then Paul continues. He doesn't stop at verse 7, which is where most of our evangelical and charismatic Trump supporters stop. He keeps going with the theme of owing. Owe no one anything except to love each other. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law, the commandments. You shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, nor any other commandment are summed up in this word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. And so on and so on. But note that the standard by which Paul thinks we should measure what we owe to Caesar is not what Caesar thinks. It's what meets the law of love, specifically the love of neighbor, which is exactly what Jesus said, and it's a direct allusion to Jesus. And loving the neighbor is not the same as loving the nation. In fact, loving the neighbor will put you at odds with people who want to give priority to the co-nationalist. And if you don't think that's true, then go and read the parable of the Good Samaritan again. All this practice of doing good to your enemies, or overcoming evil with good, or rendering with discrimination, or willingly submitting to others and laying down your life and your will, these are all examples of a socio-political attitude in the New Testament which can be summed up as benign indifference. The earliest Christians, taking their cue from Jesus, simply did not care about the things that the world around them told them was of paramount importance. Jesus, for example, did not care about ethnic purity. He did not care about defending the temple or defending Jewish chosen person status. He tells his followers not to clutch tightly to what is rightfully theirs, even when it is rightfully theirs. Like, for example, when they are wronged in a court, or when they are hit on one cheek, or when they have to give their cloak, or carry a Roman soldier's pack an extra mile. The attitude of Jesus here is one of open-handedness, not clutching tightly. And the idea here that you get is of a kind of indifference to the things that other people's whole identity was wrapped up in. Fighting the Romans, protecting your rights, making sure that Caesar doesn't get the tax. These are things that dominated the agenda of the people of his day. Jesus just doesn't really care. Likewise, Paul just doesn't really care. For the Greeks, I'm a Greek. For the Jew, I'm a Jew, he will say in one place. These are identity markers that are very important to the Greeks and Jews. And he just takes them up and lays them down. And you see him do this with his Roman citizenship, which he brings out when it matters to him and which he suppresses when it doesn't matter. You see him do this with his Jewish identity and with his claim to being a Pharisee. He'll take it out and polish it off when it's useful, but he also will let it go as well. Even in Philippians, going so far as to call all of these markers of pure Jewish identity, skubalon, for the sake of Christ, which in English we translate as rubbish or trash. But I'll be honest with you, it means excrement with human hair in it. Paul is so far from being a patriot that he considers all the things that make him a good, loyal son of Israel to be like human hairy shit for the sake of Jesus Christ. And he's doing something similar here in Romans, where he's saying, you are sons of God, you are heirs of the universe, submit to the servant for a time, give him what he wants, it's only a money, it's only honor, it's only respect. We've got bigger things to worry about. We've got the love of neighbor to worry about. That's what we're here to do. Let the government get on with its wrath-dealing and vengeance-wreaking activity. That's not for us. Also, there's 430-something verses in the book of Romans. Paul talks about government in 7 of them. He literally, words on a page, he literally does not care about government that much. And he certainly doesn't pour the same amount of emotional, intellectual, theological, philosophical, and financial resources into patriotism, government, politics, and nationhood that modern-day Christians do. Taken as a source of priority about what's important, it's pretty clear that these modern-day Christians are taking their cues much more from the modern-day sense of country than from anything Jesus or the earliest Christians said or did. And let's be honest, I spend a lot more of my time talking about this stuff than Jesus or Paul ever did either. So maybe I should just shut my big fat mouth. I guess all I want to do in myself, as well as in any fellow travelers I meet, is to try and cultivate this sense of a benign indifference to the things that everyone else is so obsessed with and which occupies so much of our time. And you cultivate this not by being malignant. It's not malign indifference. You're not attacking it. You're simply not giving these things the attention and emotional investment which they demand. You render with discrimination. Now, of course, there's going to be further conversation that needs to be had about whether there are some jobs that followers of Christ cannot do. Paul seems to imagine that there is. He seems to imagine that some of the sword-wielding activities of the government is not for believers of Jesus. We live in a world now where that seems an odd thing to say. How can something be good for one group but not for another? And are we just being parasites if we don't pick up the sword but we allow other people to wield the sword for us? So these are some interesting questions that will be dealt with later. But again, part of the political imagination of the followers of the way is to start to imagine that there might be things in this world which have a form and a function and a limited purpose, but are not for the followers of Jesus, because they have a different form, a different function, and a higher purpose. You are a child of God. Caesar is only a servant. I'll see you in the next episode as we continue our Followers of the Way, Renewing a Political Imagination.